Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming by this afternoon. I've taken off my mask for the talk so that I can be heard and everything. Hopefully stay far enough away from you all. We've got this wonderful technology to amplify my voice so I don't have to yell. So I'm really excited to chat about Barnhouse today. So I've seen a lot of familiar faces, but I'll go ahead and introduce myself if anybody is new to this series. My name is Justin Kiggins. I am trained as a neuroscientist and spent many years studying animals, animal perception and behavior. My own work and my own specialty was largely in auditory processes in birds. And so the last couple of days I've been talking about insects, because insects do a lot of cool stuff. But today and tomorrow, we're getting closer and closer to stuff that is my core expertise. So I don't do much science these days. Instead, my day job is building technology to support scientists. But I'm still very excited about animal behavior and excited to share a little bit with you all today. So today we're going to be talking about the barn owl. Beautiful creature is one of the barn owl is one of the most widely dispersed birds in the world, the most widely dispersed owl. They show up, there are kind of subspecies, but the species, I can't remember, Tito albinus or something like this, is spread throughout the entire world. Basically every single continent has barn owls. They're a prolific species, as we look at the owl, I'm curious. What do you see? what jumps out at you when you look at this owl?
Its face.
Its face. Yeah. What about the face in particular?
It's like a soft heart shape.
Yeah. There's this heart shape to the feathers throughout the face.
The facial disc.
What's that?
Facial discs.
Facial discs? Sorry, what was that? Facial discs. I don't know what a facial disc is.
It's like the owls and their face is round.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the facial disc, so that face round. Yeah.
Its beak is down.
Yeah, the beak is very much pointed down, right?
Yeah. It's where you're talking about hearing, but I don't see any ears.
You don't see any ears there, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't see any ears. They're not like bats. They don't have these big, pinnae sticking out. They do have ears, though. If we talk about our ears, strictly speaking, like our ears are kind of a combination of the outer part that we often think of as ears, as well as the inner parts. So we'll talk about their ears a little bit more soon. Barn owls are pretty incredible, and a lot of the features that stand out to us around their face are actually incredibly important for their behavior and for their natural behavior. So I've got a pretty incredible video here that the BBC can do better than me at times, let's watch this for a few minutes.
Cold weather and a blanket of snow have left us short of food.
Can you really hear that? Okay. Let me bump it. Let me see where that.
What's that?
So she's been forced to hunt for the day. Now she's got competition. A kestrel. It's one of the downsides of hunting during the daylight hours.
It's a casserole.
And even worse, the snow means she can't see her prey. So how do you find your food when it's hiding out of sight? Hunger forces the kestrel to take a chance. But his razor-sharp eyesight isn't enough in these conditions. Luckily for the barn owl, she has another superpower in her armory. Because although she can't see it, she can hear her prey, even under the snow. The kestrel simply doesn't have what it takes. So how does an owl's extraordinary hearing work?
So it's pretty incredible, right? So this owl, can everybody hear me? I think I can. So it's pretty incredible. So this owl can, was able to dive after this little creature that was hiding underneath the snow, almost as though the snow wasn't even there, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I want to talk about is to talk a little bit about what is the information that they're able to use to be able to find this? Like, how can they actually use their hearing to be able to do this? And we'll talk about a little bit more about kind of the specialized features that the owl has in order to help them do this kind of a thing, and a little bit about how their brain is structured to support this. So, if you imagine yourself as an owl, you're up there flying around. You know, you're trying to listen for this creature underneath the snow. How do you find it? What information is that available to you in your environment to hear where this little creature is scurrying around?
I mean, imagine the sound of it scratching on snow and stuff.
Yeah, so there might be some distinctive sounds that's coming from that creature. Yeah. Yep. How many sensors does the owl have to detect that?
Two.
They have two ears. They've got an ear on each side of their head. And so what this affords them is a benefit of being able to compare those two sounds against one another in order to figure out where a sound is coming from. So if you think about the most extreme case, you know, if you have a sound to your right versus to your left, the difference in, say, volume between those two sounds could help you to say, okay, this is to my left, right, or this is to my left. And indeed, through a bunch of research on animals and humans for that matter, there's basically two kind of key cues, really three, but two primary cues that various creatures use in order to identify and localize sound. One of them is the timing of the two sounds.
Mm.
So if you imagine you've got your two ears, sound travels at a fixed speed. So a sound coming from a particular location will take longer to get to the farther ear than it will to get to the proximal ear, to the ear that's closer to the sound. These changes are quite small. You know, it's just a split second. It's microseconds, tens of microseconds in time. But it's real, and it exists. The other difference, and that's kind of visualized here, if anybody's familiar looking at like plots of sound waves or something, what this is showing is a schematic of a sound that's arriving at the left ear you know, the exact same sound, the exact same pattern in both sides, arriving at the left ear a little bit later than it arrives at the right ear. The other key thing is volume, so the actual volume of the sound. So sound, as a sound source spreads out, that energy that was in the air creating the sound pressure waves close to the source dissipates. So if you imagine like each of these little lines that's being drawn here, as the sound disperses from its source, each kind of concentric sphere around the sound source is going to have the same amount of energy as the smaller sphere. So that means that for any given point in space, the sound volume drops off. And this is why sounds are quieter when they're farther away from us. They drop off with that circumference. Additionally, the fact that you've got a big old head in the way effectively causes a shadow, like a sound shadow that is created on the other ear, which amplifies this difference. So this also is can be a major cue that's used. One of the interesting things is that this time difference between the left and the right ear, it can be very precisely calculated.
Yeah.
So based on the distance that the two ears are apart, that angle and the timing, the difference in distance from reaching one ear to the other, is basically corresponds to that angle. And so what it works out to be is that it's only tens of microseconds for the barn owl between a sound arriving in one ear versus another ear for some of the most precise bits of acuity. So this field is referred to sometimes as psychoacoustics, like the psychology of the acoustical environment. And in general, in psychoacoustics, we refer to like the minimum resolution as like the minimum audible angle. Like what's the smallest angle that I can distinguish? And so if you all please stick your thumb out, reach out your arm, stick your thumb out in front of you, okay? That width of your thumb is about 2 degrees. So if we have 360 degrees all the way around us, the width of your thumb is about 2 degrees. Human acuity in front of us, like square in front of us, is on the order of like 5 degrees or so that we might be able to tell if we're like off center a little bit. At the periphery, we're much worse. But in the front, we're around 5 degrees, 5 to 10.
But does that mean that you hear better from what's coming straight towards you than what's beside you? Is that what you just said?
Yeah. Well, like I can tell I can synthesize this. But you know, if you've got a sound that's in front of you and then it moves 10 degrees, I can recognize that pretty easily.
Okay.
If I have a sound that's like at 70 degrees and it moves to 80 degrees, I can't tell that difference as well. Yeah. So for owls, the minimum difference that they can recognize is about 4 degrees. So about the two widths of your thumb that they can tell the difference between. And they
That's
can.
Pretty cool.
What's that?
That's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. Also, I forgot to say yesterday, and then nobody asked questions. Bug me. Please interrupt. Please ask questions.
Did you say that we can do 5 and they can do 4?
We're on the order of like 5 to 10. Yeah.
Okay.
We're on the order of 5 to 10. That's so ours are pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Why is this so different from the Kestrel?
From the Kestrel?
Yeah, the Kestrel that didn't catch the mice, but this guy got the mice because he can hear.
Yeah. We'll get to that a little bit more. I don't know exactly what the acuity is of the Kestrel. The simple version is that the Kestrel relies way more on eyesight. The owls are usually hunting at night. That was one of the things the narrator kind of mentioned. And so by being a nighttime bird, a nighttime raptor, they have much larger eyes. They rely on their eyes a lot, but they have this kind of amped up visual or auditory system.
Do they have the same, you just talked about the 4 degrees, do they have the same peripheral?
I don't know. I'm not sure what the peripheral acuity is or how. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what that is. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that I've talked about so far, you know, we're talking about left versus right differences. There's also kind of up versus down differences that we'll get into in a few minutes. Sorry. The other thing too, going back to the question about humans, our heads are bigger. Mm-hmm. So this challenge of acuity ends up being easier if you got a bigger head. Because the bigger your head is and the further apart your ears are, the longer the time delay between the two ears for a given change in the angle. So it ends up that that becomes a trade-off on the neuroscience side and on the biology, because what it means is that now for a nervous system to be able to do this computation, for an owl, it's around like tens of microseconds. For a human, we're on the order of like hundreds of microseconds. So it can be a slower computation that's a little bit easier for biology and like neurons to kind of do this computation. So I kind of like, you know, sketched out this idea, you know, like okay, so the sound timing is different. There's a delay in the timing between the left and the right ear for the owl. But then how does a brain actually do this computation? How does a brain actually compare the time course of two signals? Any thoughts on how that might happen?
So they have a clock in their antenna?
Wrong animal. So one of the, microsecond time difference. So I meant to put in the slide here, it's a schematic of a neuron, so instead I'm going to draw up on the board here. So all animals with nervous systems, so vertebrates like us, vertebrates like owls, mammals, as well as invertebrates like our locusts or our monarchs, all have neurons. And the way that the main way that our neurons work is that there's often a cell body, which is kind of the main part, and neurons are cells just like any other cell in your body. And so they've got mitochondria, and they've got their vesicles, and they've got a membrane, they have a nucleus. Like, they're just cells. They do all the other things that cells do. However, they've got other specialized features that help them to kind of do neural things. One of them is what we call dendrites. And so dendrites are these little relatively short things that stick out from the cells. And dendrites bring incoming information into the nucleus. So information kind of flows into the dendrites. And what that is, what I mean by information is I mean an individual kind of electrical signal. So, and then on the other side of the neuron is an axon. And our axon is sort of where neurons send their information out. This is a schematic version. There's tons of exceptions to this, especially if you start getting into like worms and insects. They're gonna be super weird things that don't follow this canon. But for the most part, this is a nice way to think about how individual cells work. And this axon that sends information out then would often be connected to another neuron somewhere else through its dendrites. And so this connection right here between the neuron between this neuron's axon and this other neuron's dendrite is what scientists call a synapse. And so if you could imagine chains of these, or networks of these, what I mean when I'm talking about computation is that whether or not this, what will happen is that based on the signals that are coming into this neuron, which are basically just electrical signals, kind of analog electrical signals, if there's enough analog electrical signals coming in, that'll trigger an electrical pulse that'll go down the axon. That'll cause activity at the synapse that will then create a new electrical signal along that dendrite. So it's kind of this chain effect of this neuron kind of gathering up a little bit of information, sending a signal down the axon, and then that can get picked up by another neuron. And so what was proposed when, back a number of different ways of kind of doing these time computations have been proposed. And one of the early models that was proposed was this model called the Jeffress model, by a guy named Jeffress. And so the idea is that if you had kind of an axon coming from the right ear and an axon coming from the left ear, if both ears have gotten the same auditory signal, and sent the same spike train, the same kind of pattern of information down it, that if you set up a network like this, and if the timing was slow enough, then you might end up with something that could approximate these time differences. So if you imagine, if the sound is coming from right dead in front of you, then you end up with the exact same signal coming into both ears at the exact same time. So these spike trains that are coming from the right will go traveling down here. These spike trains that are coming from the left will go traveling down here. These ones will hit this neuron about the same one these ones hit this neuron. And if these neurons are constructed such that that they have to hit a threshold of having both signals simultaneously, then when these spikes hit this neuron, nothing happens. When these spikes hit this neuron, nothing happens. Okay, so they keep traveling down, same thing happens. When eventually they hit this one in the middle, and this guy in the middle hears or senses both spikes from the left and from the right-hand side at the same time, and is able to send out a pulse. And so so you can imagine this then, you know, this one kind of sending out a pulse that then gets mapped to, like, okay, this is in front of me. And they've got, this also has this advanced model that says, okay, well, things are noisy, you know, maybe the spikes are a little bit stochastic, and so then there's ways that they said, all right, well, we don't want to just rely on one spike, let's make sure that we have a certain number of spikes that are simultaneous. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of like have this accumulation effect to be able to make that decision. And then for the owl, basically, these things could then be mapped on to like musculature that helps them to then adjust their head in order to zero in on where they're going. So just a proposal, you know, this kind of works. Go ahead. Yeah.
So on this model, I understand how it determines where the center is, but I don't understand how the other four would get activated.
The other four would not be activated.
Okay.
Oh, I see. No. So then.
I mean, that's like if the sound comes off center, then I understand why that middle one gets detected. But if something comes from the right side, how does that work with it?
So then, if something comes from the right side first, so if the right side is first, so then spikes come to the right side and they hit this one. This guy hasn't doesn't have any spikes yet.
Right.
Okay. So these spikes keep going, you know, still nothing here. These spikes keep going, and now we start getting spikes from the left-hand side.
Okay.
And so now these spikes reach kind of this one on the left about the same time that these spikes made from the right hit this one.
Okay.
But they still don't trigger.
Yeah.
But then.
So then that left one, that left box would trigger.
Triggers this left box.
Yeah. Here. Right. Okay.
And so then this goes out, and so then that decision is that, all right, this is on the right.
Okay.
This was the right ear beating.
Got it.
So the mapping here ends up being inverted from the left and the right. So it's, if it ends up that that the right ear got the acoustical information earlier, then it would be these coincidence detectors on the left-hand side of this mapping that that send their pulses first. Yeah.
So what if, like, what if there are a few different rodents under the snow in the same general area, but they're close enough to each other where it could, like, causes the algorithm?
Yeah, yeah, it could, like, cause confusion. Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So that's one of the reasons that this model has this this sort of separate, this, like, coincidence counter step. So the idea here is that basically that acoustical information coming from a particular rodent would get translated into a particular pattern of spikes. And so each of those rodents would have their own pattern of spikes that acoustical information, that their movement, would translate into. And so then the timing of that pattern would be a little bit different. So what's interesting about this is...
Some are more on the right, more...
Yeah, yeah, if they're like 10 degrees separate,
yeah.
Then it's still going to kind of go down, and you might end up with some messy information, but over the accumulation of the information from the two sources, the key is that it would have to be the same pattern of spikes at the same time. So one animal might be consistently sending spikes down to this one. The other animal might be consistent, or sound source might be consistently sending spikes down to this one. And then there might be a couple of stray things that are kind of in there that are sending spikes to the wrong thing. But the idea is that these ones would just be like waiting for a certain accumulation to come up. But you're right. I think that this is a diagrammatic model, and we can basically start to expand on this and like try to account for exactly these types of challenges. There's a whole body of much more recent work. A lot of this work that I'm talking about today, at least on the neural side, was kind of fleshed out in the late 70s and early 80s. And today there's a whole other layer of work about attention and even owls that they can focus their attention on, say, like one animal or the other in order to improve their acuity. So this is great. Jeffress thought up this idea, sketched out this model. Hey, here's one way that it might work. It turns out in the owl, he's basically right. In the owl, there's a structure. I can't remember what it stands for, but it's in the midbrain, the NL. That seems to be full of these types of coincidence detectors. So there's actually two of them. There's kind of one on each side of the brain that do something very similar, and then their information kind of gets aggregated. But the idea is that this is in the midbrain, so there's two of them. And so in neuroscience, or in biology more generally, ipsilateral would be on the same side, contralateral would be on the other side. So fibers, neuron axons that are coming in from one side go into this area NL, and then synapse onto neurons in NL, and they synapse onto the same neurons that are coming in from the contralateral side. There's a lot of redundancy. It's not quite as simple as the Jeffress line, but this helps to deal with the messiness and noisiness of biology. But what it ends up being is that along this area of NL, you have neurons in these areas that basically map onto this left and right aspect of visual space. Such that if you were to record the activity of individual cells in here, and then stimulate the fibers or playback audio to the two ears, the neural activity and where you get peak neural activity in each of these zones corresponds to this left and right mapping. So this area NL in the owl's brain ends up mapping on to these left and right differences. That's how owls do it. And it's kind of a, it's largely just a coincidence that the one of the earliest models of how to do this, the Jeffress model, ends up being the model that happens in owls. It's not the model that happens in a lot of other creatures that have to do the exact same thing. So chickens have a somewhat similar model, but a much more simple structure for ML, a little bit less redundancy, a little bit less acuity, and coarser resolution. You know, there's no evolutionary, not the same evolutionary pressure on chickens to hunt for creatures at night. Gerbils also have very good left-right acuity, but have an entirely different mechanism. They actually, there's this one cell, well, a series of them, but a fairly large cell called MSO, large cells in the MSO, where a lot of this calculation that kind of happens between multiple neurons in the owl and chicken largely happens within the cell itself. Kind of more of a local computation. Geckos are even weirder. They actually don't really rely on neural processing to do this computation. It's actually more of an acoustic computation that happens within their mouth cavity. And which is actually sort of similar to crickets, are also able to do this, but their ears are on their legs. And so it ends up being basically like interference within like a drum. If you imagine like hitting a drum on both sides and like the weird interference you can get in there, is what geckos and other animals rely on.
Question?
Yeah.
What's AM?
What's AM? Where are we at?
AM, like those things. Yeah.
Oh, AN? I can't remember. It's a particular brain structure. I can look it up for you. It's like anterior nucleus or something like that. The idea though is that it's these structures that they have that they've identified in the chicken, the owl, and the gerbil is all in the midbrain. So we have like a couple different layers of our brain. We've got like the cortex that we often think about. That's the one that we see in pictures. Then we have these deeper structures that kind of connect the cortex and funnel information from the periphery up into the cortex. All of these areas in the chicken and the owl and the gerbil is in this midbrain area. Okay, so we've talked a lot about kind of left and right information. What about up and down? Right, so that owl's flying, you know, it's not just good enough that he gets to the left or the right of the little creature, right? He's got to nail it in elevation. As well. Any thoughts on, oh, go ahead.
Well, this might be a thought on it, but it's also a question, because I noticed in the video, the owl seemed to be able to sort of hover. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell whether that was slowed down for effect or they have a way of flying that allows them to stay above a single area longer.
Yeah, I'm honestly not sure. Yeah, I don't know. But it is like, I think one of the a lot of birds too are very good at keeping their head balanced even while the rest of their body is flying and adjusting. Just their vestibular systems are very good at managing this, which is probably part of it. And I can imagine that's going to be incredibly important for them, right? Is to be able to keep that head steady in order to target where they're trying to get in.
Because you're flying over the pretty fast rate of it.
Like, yeah.
Harder to get the up and down part.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you seen that video of the guy, he's got his pet owl, he just like takes it and he's like twisting it everywhere and the head's just...
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, but yeah, I should get that for the next time I give this talk. Yeah. So for elevation, it's kind of a funny story. And this is where I think owls are especially cool. So I don't have, well, I. This is a different species of owl. This is a boreal owl.
Oh.
And the reason that I, this is the skull of a boreal owl. And what do you notice about this skull?
Big holes.
There's some big holes. There's the big holes of the eyes, and then there's the big holes that these arrows are pointing at.
It's asymmetrical?
It's asymmetrical. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's, and so what these big holes are back here is their ears.
One's higher than the other.
One's higher than the other, exactly. I'm showing you the boreal owl because it's just so visually easy to see it. It's a little bit more visually subtle for barn owls, but a very similar structure that they have this asymmetry in their skull around their ears. And what this does is this effectively, remember how we were talking about the, we talked about the shadow that a head can create to create level differences? What this asymmetry does is this asymmetry amplifies and enforces level differences vertically as well. So if you have a sound source that's coming from up above, it goes into this ear very readily, but it's more occluded from this ear, and vice versa for a sound source that's coming from down below. Yeah?
Does the shape of the cavity also have an EQ kind of?
Yeah, so there's a whole, yeah, so I'm gonna, these two main things is what we're talking about, but there's a whole other level of this of spectral cues that are much more subtle. And yeah, we should come back to that because it's the EQ stuff is super interesting for humans as well, because our pinnae contribute to this a lot. But yeah, the other piece is that there is this shape and particularly, let me unpack that question a little bit. So if I swing back here a little bit, if we think about these differences in timing and differences in volume, the reliability of these two cues depends in part on the spectrum of audio that we're dealing with. So for high frequency sounds, a shadow is greater. Whereas low-frequency sounds, you think about like somebody drives by, you know, with a bass in their car, right? That, those low-frequency sounds can travel through things. Low-frequency sounds can travel through the head as well. So low-frequency sounds have less of an impact on the volume differences between the two ears. High-frequency sounds, it ends up being a little bit more difficult to do this computation. Because unless you're just looking at the very onset of the sound. So frequency becomes an important component in a bunch of this. So with the owls and with their head, so what this ends up doing is kind of two things. One thing is that it ends up being that that the sound volume differences between the two ears is a major cue for up and down. But it's not the old, but you can't exclusively rely on it for up and down because there's also kind of a left-right difference. So they actually have to kind of merge this information together. And what it means is that they end up having a fairly complex map in their head, relying both on the timing differences as well as the level differences. Mm. So what each of these plots is showing is this is showing a plot of both azimuthal differences, so left-right differences, as well as elevation differences, so the up-down differences. And what each of these lines are is either the ISO timing line or ISO level line. So this dark purple line in the middle here is all the spaces in visual space where the timing will not have a difference. And similarly, on this other side, you know, this kind of periwinkle color right here is all the places in visual space where the level will not have a difference. And so timing alone isn't going to give you the right information, particularly with these asymmetrical ears, because the asymmetrical ears are going to be messing with timing as well, especially at the high elevation and low elevation areas. But with a combination of timing and level, the owl is able to zero in and pinpoint very precisely on where the sound source is. Any questions on that?
Is this empirical or is this measured somehow in with the owl, in the owl? How do they, what experiments do they do to get
this? No, this is a really good question. So these timings that we're talking about, so this data right here is the computation of the timing differences as well as the of the level differences. And so you can gather this data by putting tiny microphones in owl ears. So I've done this with humans. I did it one of my, I've done this with humans where you put little tiny microphones in a human's ears, and you can compute these differences very specific, very closely. By putting the microphones in the ears, you can also get a bunch of the spectral information yeah, you can get the spectral information. There's like an entire like filtering that takes place. So that's how this data can be gathered. Okay, so, let's see. So what did we talk about? So we talked about the skull size. We talked about skull shape, overall timing differences. As we had noted very early on, barn owls have this very interesting shape of their face. What it turns out is that these feathers are actually highly specialized feathers. So there's basically three types of feathers on the barn owl face and head. Up on kind of their top head, way up here, is what they call contour feathers. These are basically the same feathers that they have elsewhere on their body. It's a standard feather. Inside of their face here is this auricular feather. These guys are super thin, super wispy. They basically barely occlude any sound. So sound travels very readily through them. Along this ridge are these reflector feathers. And these reflector feathers are super firm, and they're super tightly packed around that area. So it basically just kind of captures the sound.
Where are the, can you laser pointer where the ears are?
Yeah, so the ears are like back here.
Okay.
They're like kind of right behind the eyes. Yeah.
You can basically say their face is like a sounding board.
Yeah. Their face is like, it's like a sounding board. It's like capturing that. If you imagine, a tuba, and you like stick your ear up to the inside of the tuba, that, you know, it's capturing that sound and funneling it in, into their ears. And this has been confirmed empirically too, that you can go through and you can calculate then the interaural time difference and the interaural level differences. So on the left is the timing differences, on the right is the level differences. By leaving the ruff intact or by taking out these reflector feathers and see how that affects these timing differences. So you stick the little microphones in their ears, you take off the feathers, see what the timing differences are. And one of the interesting things is that it does affect the timing differences between the left and the right, but what it really affects is this up and down difference. It's really affecting the level differences, which is the primary cue for elevation. Okay. So, and we've talked a lot about the auditory system.
So, you know, they just roll out of the egg one day, and they have all this incredibly complex asymmetry and a big ear and a little ear and all this stuff, this equipment. Do they have to practice to get good at that, or is there a toddler stage? And then, so then they can they just dive down and get a mouse pretty quick? Or
that's a really good question. I don't know much about the developmental processes for this behavior. That's my short answer. The slightly longer answer, which I think we'll kind of point to that, is kind of on the next couple of slides, which I think it doesn't answer your question, but it gets into some interesting questions around learning and how much of this is structured and what isn't.
Yeah. If you're just going to get to it, or if it's not permanent, you can say, but like. So this is kind of up, down, side to side, but then also it seems like their acuity must be really amazing, and their ability to kind of like filter out extraneous noise to hear a mouse underneath the snow must be pretty amazing too.
Yeah. I'm not,
What's up
yeah, I don't have any slides dedicated to this.
Okay.
Um, Yeah, this is the short version. I don't know exactly what's the short version is that yes, they can. There's more recent research, like I had mentioned, like a lot of this research was done kind of decades ago. There's a one of the pioneers of this work over the past like 5-10 years or so has turned a lot of his focus to attention.
Yeah.
And to kind of attentional constraints and the role of attention, the role of expectation in a lot of these processes. So setting up experiments where they are, you know, you've got owls in a room that are, you know, and they like set up bait or something for the owl to fly to. And then they're able to change those expectations. You know, make it so that every time the owl comes in the room, it's over here, but this time it's over here. So there's different ways that the folks have started to explore this. I don't know much in terms of like the key conclusions there. But it definitely is the case that the owls are able to leverage a lot of the similar attentional processes that we use. So a lot of what we rely on, for example, is we rely on vision a lot. You know, like in human psychoacoustics, it's called the cocktail party effect, that like you're at a cocktail party, there's a lot of people chatting, but you're able to engage with the person that you're focused on, you're able to talk with them, you're able to understand them. Then what they start saying is kind of boring, you know, they're going on and on, and then you can start like eavesdropping on kind of the person behind you.
Yeah, totally.
And that ability to kind of switch your like attentional spotlight is pretty incredible. And it does seem that barn owls have some similar processes where they can zero in, focus their attention on what they're going after and ignore other things. Yeah.
Yeah, question. So I feel like snowy owls also hunt rodents, but have, like, it looks to me like they maybe have a slightly different face shape than other owls. Like, is that just a trick of the feathers, or?
I have no idea, honestly. Yeah, I don't know what the, you know, I'm mostly familiar with barn owls just because that's where most of the neuro research has happened. But yeah, I don't know what the kind of ecological pressures are that have, like, push, you know, owls in different directions, like why it is that these boreal owls have these, you know, have like such huge, because this is much stronger than the asymmetry.
Is it that pronounced in all little owls compared to the bigger species?
Yeah, maybe that's part of what it is. Going back to my statement about how like getting your ears farther apart can also help to emphasize these things. If it's a smaller owl,
if
that
you're
has
a tiny little owl, it might be hard.
Yeah, this is I think one of the reasons that crickets end up with their ears are on their legs. It helps them to get those two sensors as far away from each other as possible. Yeah. So
it's pretty simple.
So another, so we talked a lot about the auditory system. So I'm going to diverge just for a couple of minutes to talk about the visual systems of these guys and their interrelation. So primates in general, you know, we are very good at, we have, our eyes have a fovea where we are able to focus. I can stand here. And I can keep my head fixed, and I can look around and, you know, orient to many people in the room while keeping my head fixed. Owls can't move their eyes, really. Their eyes basically don't move. They basically stay where they are in their sockets, and all of their vision is being changed through head motion. And what it seems like this is the... What it seems to be the case is this lets them have a very tight overlay between this auditory map and this visual map. So for humans, we have to make an adjustment. We have to, if we shift our eyes over here, you know, if we're gonna try to merge our visual streams and our auditory streams, we have to take into account that shift in our eye motion. And there's like various neural processes that help to support that. For owls, they instead have evolved to have very fixed eyes to move their head around, and so the visual map of their world is very tightly overlaid with their auditory map.
They can still do this to focus, you know, far away and things close, right?
Probably, maybe.
Okay, but they can't do that.
They can't. I mean, their eyes barely move in the sockets.
Though. Really?
They barely move in the sockets. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've done. Yeah, that's a good question though about the like peripheral and distance questions. You know, there's been research on that in pigeons actually. There's been a fair bit of research on that in pigeons and like the visual areas that help to mediate that in pigeons. There's basically kind of like two separate streams for close up versus far away. But yeah, I'm not sure how that works in owls. So one of the interesting things is that, you know, I had, is that in this area of the midbrain, if we look at over here on the left, we have a couple of structures. So remember how we were talking about this area, this area through here that has this NL, that then these guys become coincidence detectors that like correspond to the difference in timing. So this area then goes to an area called the ICC, which basically maintains this map of the brain. So it's like these cells in this part of ICC correspond to 0%. These cells correspond to 20% off. These cells correspond to 40% off. And they map onto this area called the ICX. Right adjacent to this area in the midbrain is the optic tectum, which is bringing in input from the retina and from the visual system. And it's structured such that the center of the retinal field, it overlays almost perfectly with the center of the auditory field. And these two areas basically map onto each other almost perfectly. So one of the questions that the scientists asked them is kind of going to your question of like, okay, is this genetic? Is this endogenous? Does one lead the other? What happens if we mess with this mapping? So what they did is, for a certain amount of time, they put little goggles on the owls with prisms. If anybody's gone to like the science museum or something, you put on like drunk glasses or one of these things. Basically, it's these little prism glasses that would shift the visual field by like 20 degrees. So the owl, of course, is very confused the first initially when this happens, but then adjusts to it and is able to adjust to it and is able to navigate and get around in its world, not out in the wild. This would be in a laboratory and controlled environment, but it's able to kind of do its thing. And what's interesting and what they found then by going in after this these kind of retina experiments and recording electrical activity and neural activity from individual cells in this area. Is that it seems to be that the auditory system adjusts to correspond to the visual system. Mm. So those cells that in the auditory system that used to be at the zero mark are now at the 20% mark, because that's now where the new zero mark is for the visual system. And if I can't remember exactly what the timeline is for this, but it's on the course of like days or weeks. This isn't something that takes like years to figure out. But what it points to, I think, you know, not only is it kind of, you know, interesting in terms of like which nervous system, you know, which system, you know, dominates the other, but just how important it is for owls and how integrally connected the visual and auditory systems are for owls to be able to support all of this behavior. So with that, that is all I've got for today. Yeah.
Back to the last thing there.
Uh-huh.
Can you surmise that one leads the other, or is it just too hard to do the experiment the other way of
You mean in terms of like the development?
Right. If you could do an experiment where you shifted the auditory input by 20 degrees, would it shift how it mapped as well?
Oh, I see what you mean. I would argue that maybe those aren't equivalent. I don't know. I'm not sure.
And is there a question back to the original question someone asked over here? Is it possible that there's a tuning process like in machine learning where the ear is picking up stuff and you're looking and so you're starting to tune and to
build that correspondence?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that that's exactly this tuning process. I think that's exactly that, you know, this process is like a retuning, right? That you're retuning. You've got a mismatch, you've got some error signal that is very similar to like a machine learning process. You've got some error signal that is retuning to recalibrate this. The only reason I caution about kind of development is because there's often just very different mechanisms that affect learning during development versus a mature nervous system. We'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, because tomorrow is going to be about song learning with songbirds, where there's a lot of interesting things about developmental learning versus mature animals learning. I don't know what to think about, like, if you were to invert this and if you were to mess with the auditory cues separate from the visual cues, or instead of visual cues. Yeah.
You may not have studied this, but it always amazes me. I see a robin.
Yeah.
I hear that worm. Do they have any? Do you have any idea of similar kind of things?
What was that?
But robins can hear a worm under the ground.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Are they really operating with a similar kind of thing? Would they detect that?
I would suppose so. I mean, I think that, you know, going back to my kids, we just started raising chickens. And those chickens, you know, they dive after and they get the bugs and ants and what have you. Certainly the chicken midbrain has a similar but less developed structure from the owl. So a lot of this localization stuff, I mean, it's basically tons of animals use it. Tons of animals use this type of localization. I think it largely has to do, it's more about the acuity and kind of the specific needs of the animal. Yeah.
You mentioned yesterday that with butterfly migrations, the military is one funder of that research because of their interest. Who funds this kind of research on the, are there any interesting things about who's interested in that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of, there's more of, I think a lot of this research is a little bit easier to get funded from the NIH. So the work that I had done in sound localization was more oriented toward humans. But it's actually the professor that I worked with who's now involved in some of the owl research with attentional stuff as well, because this attentional stuff becomes incredibly important for human research as well. A lot of that is funded by the NIH. The NIH has an entire segment focused on like deafness and communication disorders, NIDCD. And so they fund a lot of auditory research. And so I think that if we look overall at funding of like biomedical, of biology research, we'll say, the largest funder by far is the NIH, like hands down. The NIH funds most of it. Especially if it's squarely biomedical, as we shift out of stuff where like the biomedical relevance starts becoming more tenuous, then you're either kind of in NSF territory, if it's like ecological biology, like ecology, like that stuff is much more under NSF territory. And then folks like the military kind of like fills in the gaps in different places. So like this Jeffress model, I don't know where the funding came from, but we were talking a little bit about like neuromorphic design and you know, before they had identified that, you know, the actual structures in the outer brain seemed to correspond to this model, you know, this model was being used to kind of develop robots that could navigate and follow a sound source and things like that. I don't specifically know whether the military was funding that work, but I think that yeah, some of this stuff gets into some military research. For most of these papers, though, you can go, I mean, pretty much every scientific paper at the very end has a little blurb that says who funded it. Most funders require it. So it's not hard to, usually not too hard to disentangle who's behind the work. So in summary, Barnells are primarily relying on timing differences to distinguish their left-right location. Level differences to distinguish up and down locations. They've got an interesting shaped skull that is asymmetrical that helps to improve their up-down localization. Their facial ruff has these specialized features that help improve sound localization acuity, and their visual system is very tightly mapped to their olfactory system. And so with that, thank you very much. Thanks.